It's been great to be back here, looking forward to our time in the Word. Let me just say something about this evening, so that you have an understanding of what to expect. This evening, I'm actually going to go into the Gospels, and I'm going to take one, maybe two verses in the Gospel, and I want to develop a simple principle that's developed in those two verses, and then I want to weave together a historic story, that's a missionary story. As I've already said, my heart is very much in missions. I've done a lot of collegiate training as it relates to the mission field, and I really want just to get a sense of what God is doing from a global perspective and bearing that out of the Gospel of John and looking at it even from a historic perspective. I realize that on Sunday evening, particularly, even as Dwayne said, toward the end of the summer, it's easy to take that time for oneself. But I actually think this evening will be really enjoyable as we go through the Gospel of John and look at that one particular story. This morning, we're going to start in 2 Kings chapter 6. So if you'll go with me to 2 Kings chapter 6, our focus this morning is really going to be on a single story in the story or the narrative of Elisha. 2 Kings chapter 6. In a moment, I'm going to read the story. And even before I read the story, I'm going to give you a little bit of a listening strategy, even for the message, because dealing with Old Testament narratives, you have to listen in different ways. And when you do hear different preachers, it's good to have an understanding of kind of what's coming. So I'm going to make some promises to you and establish some benchmarks so that you know where we're going this morning and ultimately you know where we're going to land the plane. I think that's going to be important for us. But I also think it's important for you to, as we read the text, to have open eyes and so that you are seeing the natural divisions and the natural themes in the text. It's one of the things when we look at stories, we want to be looking at repetition. We want to be looking at structure. And all those things will develop as far as the morning is concerned. This particular story reminds me of works of art. I am by no means an art connoisseur, and I have no gift from a fine art perspective at all. But I do enjoy art. Matter of fact, I enjoy multiple genres of art. But from a personal perspective, paintings from the West are my favorites. And so the works of Remington and of Russell and of Caitlin and of Moran, those are works that I just thoroughly enjoy. When I was in grad school, I was introduced to the work of Bev Doolittle. Bev Doolittle has a particular style of painting, which she defines as the camouflage technique. Just take a look at it for a moment here. All right, the camouflage technique is a technique that is used to communicate obviously obvious things that you see. But the more that you look at that picture, the more that you recognized that you didn't see initially. So if I were to ask the simple question of how many pintos are in the picture, some of you are now starting to count. And you're looking, and I trust you've already gotten to the point where you can say four, perhaps five, perhaps six, perhaps seven. One of the abilities that Bev Doolittle has is to be a master craftsman with the paintbrush so that you recognize that you have initial sight, and then you develop what I'll define as secondary sight. You see beyond the obvious. Second picture, now that you're done counting ponies, you can count eyes. The forest has eyes. And again, I could probably leave that up for the duration of the message, but if I did so, you would stop listening. For the most part, most of you have stopped listening about 3 minutes ago. I recognize that. Because what you're looking at is you're looking at a master artist who paints both externally, but then also has the capacity to penetrate beyond what the eyes naturally see. Layer upon layers that are not obvious at first glance. Let me simply suggest that as we get into 2 Kings chapter 6, that this particular text has layer upon layer. And that indeed, part of the theme of this particular text is seeing beyond the obvious. Again, let me give you a little bit of a listening strategy before I read the text. Listening strategy would simply be this. As I read the text, what you should be looking for is you should be looking for the natural development of any story. Every story usually has a context in which the story is addressed. And then it will have conflict. A story without conflict is actually relatively boring. That conflict will lead to a climax. Generally speaking, the spiritual truth or the theological truth is bound out within the climax of the story. And then after that, you're going to have resolution. And so biblical stories, like any great literature, has structure to it. It will have context, followed by conflict, followed by a climax, followed by resolution. Bound within that, there's going to be themes that develop. And so as I read this story in just a moment, you should be looking for repetitions of themes. In this particular story, look at the number of times that sight is mentioned. Who is seeing what? Right? That's going to move us through the story with purpose. Second thing you should be looking at is the use of prayer within this particular story. Because prayer is mentioning every time there is a prayer, it is then followed by the act of God. So that connection is going to be important as far as this story is concerned. So the first probably 20 minutes of the sermon is simply going to be reading the story. Then I want to walk back through the story, and I want us just to make several observations. I want you to understand that biblical stories are great literature. There's irony. There's humor. This particular story, by the way, is filled with humor. And you should be able to just enjoy the story as it is written. But we're not simply reading the Bible for the sake of literature. Biblical narratives not only are great literature, but they're great theology. They tell us about who God is, they tell us about how he works, and they tell us how we should respond. Thus, Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that Old Testament examples, our stories are given for us as examples that we can learn from them. So the first 20 to 25 minutes of our message is going to be just focusing on the story, walking through it. But we dare not leave it as such. So the last 20 to 25 minutes, I want to stop. And I simply want to ask the question, what are the lessons for the marketplace? What should we be learning from this story? I'm going to suggest that there's five lessons for us this morning. Two of them we'll deal with relatively briefly because they deal with external factors. And then three of them really deal with who we are, how we need to respond to this particular story. All right, so that should give you an idea of what to expect. Your Bibles are open, 2 Kings chapter 6. Let me begin reading in verse 8. Simply says this. Now the king of Aram was warring against Israel, and he counseled with his servants, saying, in such a place shall be my camp. The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Arameans are coming down there. And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, so that he guarded himself there more than once or twice. Now the heart of the king of Aram was enraged over this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, will you tell me which one of you is for the king of Israel? In essence, which one of you is the traitor? And one of his servants said, no, my lord. O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. So he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and take him. And he told him, saying, behold, he is in Dothan. He sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. Now when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and had gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? So he answered, do not fear. For those who are with us are more than those that are with them. Then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When they came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people with blindness, I pray. So he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Then Elisha said to them, this is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he brought them to Samaria. When they had come to Samaria, Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. Then the king of Israel, when he saw them, said to Elisha, My father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? And he answered and said, You shall not kill them. Would you kill those you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. So he prepared a great feast for them. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they came to their master. And the marauding bands of the Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel. Start with context. What do we know about this main character by the name of Elisha? Obviously, we know that he's a prophet, but really, he's a unique figure as it relates to the Old Testament. Elisha is one of those prophets that moves with ease in and out of the common man while at the same time moving in and out with kings. He could interact with ordinary people as it relates to providing bread, oil, water, and even raising the dead. Yet he was also a significant national and indeed international figure. When you read the totality of his stories, you see him interacting with multiple kings from multiple nations. And every king knew him, and every king feared him. He was a man to be respected. Elisha also was a prophet in the northern tribes. If you're familiar with the history of Israel, the northern tribes, after the division between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, never had a good king. Matter of fact, the land of the north never turned their hearts back to God, and thus were led away in captivity in 722 by the Assyrians. And so one could look at the life of Elisha and simply say, all right, Elisha ministered for multiple years in the north. He preached the message of God, and yet at the end of his life, he seemingly was a failure. The people never responded. The people never repented. And thus we have to ask the question, why then is this particular prophet, who seemingly did not have positive results, why was his story recorded in so much of Scripture? The Elisha story is one of the longest throughout the Chronicles and throughout the Kings. I would simply remind you that 2 Kings was written to a people that were in exile. As they're in exile, separated from the throne, separated from the tabernacle and from the temple, that in their mind, the question was simply this: how can we get back and how can we remain faithful? In the midst of chaos, in the midst of sinfulness, in the midst of a world that seemingly is spinning out of control, how can we remain faithful? I'll simply suggest for us this morning that the story of Elisha demonstrates a faithful response to a faithful God in the absolute tsunami of unbelief. Elisha was the model for the exile. This is what you do when the world is spinning out of control. This is what you do when people are not responding to the truth that surrounds them. How did Elisha do that? Well, I think the answer to the question is actually found in this concept of being a prophet. Another word for prophet is simply that of a seer. And a prophet or a seer is someone who sees clearly. Someone who has the ability to connect the known, that which is visible, with the unknown, that which is invisible. Because a prophet believed in the unknown. That's who Elisha is. Now, let's walk back through the story. Fascinating story. As I said, every story has conflict, followed by climax, followed by resolution. So just walk with me back through the story. The conflict is actually found in verses 8 through 14. This particular section, what's happening is the king of Aram, who's probably most likely one of the overlords of Syria, he's marauding into Israel. And as he's marauding into Israel, his desire is to capture the king of the north. In this context, the king of northern Israel. And as he does so, he goes in and he's setting up particular locations where he could kidnap him, where he can kill him. But every single plan that is established, Elisha communicates to the king of Israel what the plan is, so that the king of Israel then avoids that particular location. And you can just imagine the heightened level of frustration. The king of Aram says, we're going to go south. We're going to go to this city. We're going to go to that city. And every single location that's established is then discovered. And the king of Israel escapes capture. Well, what do you do in that context? Well, you call a war council. So as the climax continues, or as the conflict continues, now the king of Aram calls together all of his advisors, all of his captains, and simply says, which one of you is the traitor? The king of Aram only sees that which is in front of him. He doesn't see the unseen. He doesn't give consideration to anything that's supernatural. And because of that, the only conclusion that he can draw is that there's a traitor in the midst. And so he asks the question, and I love the answer. Someone had the boldness to look at him and to simply communicate, Elisha, Elisha knows what you're whispering in your bedroom. Now you got to stop and think about this. This is a wicked, arrogant king. And he was just told by one of his captains that Elisha is so profound that he knows what he's saying in his bedroom. So what's the king do? If I were the king at that point in time, I'd start whispering. He doesn't. Instead, he just, next step, a man of the world. Well, show me where he is and let's go get him. At that point in time. Now, again, common sense would communicate that if Elisha knows what he's whispering in the bedroom, he certainly knows what's being spoken loudly within the palace. But nonetheless, the king of Aram gathers his army together. He goes down to Dotham with his, it was defined as a great army, and he surrounds the city. This is the conflict. The conflict is simply the attack on both the king of Israel and ultimately the attack on Elisha. The heathen are coming after the people of God. Now we have the climax. The climax is actually developed for us in verses 15 through 19. And really the climax is developed in three different elements of sight. The first is simply what the servant sees. The second is what Elisha sees. And then the third is what the army of Syria doesn't see. Let's walk through each one of those. What does the servant see? Well, the servant wakes up in the morning, and as he walks out, he sees that there is a great army surrounding the city. And I love his words. We see this in verse 15. He simply says this, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" Now, within the English text, that word alas sounds so melodramatic. It's alas. But the way that particular term is used within the Old Testament canon is this is a word that communicates dire circumstances that lead to death and destruction. So it's very, very appropriate. The servant wakes up, he looks out, he sees the army, and he simply cries out, "Alas, we are doomed." And the army of the king of Israel is not there. They're utterly exposed. They've been caught. And thus he goes from alas to words of panic. What shall we do? Now, most of us would immediately connect with the servant. You wake up, circumstances are not at all what you planned on. You're seemingly on the outside looking in, and you're about ready to be overtaken. And so those words so easily can creep up within our own lives. Alas, what am I to do? That's what the servant sees. What does Elisha see? Well, interestingly enough, even as the servant is echoing these words, "Alas, what shall we do?" Elisha is actually standing there with him. Elisha is seeing the exact same thing that the servant is seeing. Yet he's seeing something beyond that. Did Elisha know that the armies would be there? Certainly he did. Did he quake? Did he quiver? Did he run? Not at all. A man of God recognizes that there will be individuals that will be coming after him, that trouble is a part of life. You don't run from it. You embrace it. But what you do is you see beyond those particular circumstances. So what does Elisha do? He simply communicates to the servant these words, "Do not fear. Verse 16, words of comfort. And then he communicates a foundation for his comfort. For those who are with us are more than those that are with them. Then he moves beyond even the theological. He first addresses the emotional, don't fear. Then he deals with the cognitive, with the theological. Because those that are with us are more than those that are with them. And then he goes to the supernatural. And he simply says, Lord, open his eyes. And God does it. Which, by the way, anytime I read this story, this begs the question. And the question that it begs in my mind is, did Elisha always see chariots of fire? And when he woke up in the morning, when he walked out, yes, the servants saw all the armies, but did Elisha just naturally see those wherever he went? And if so, that's certainly a supernatural gift that God gave him. And if not, then Elisha could speak in faith, knowing that the Lord of hosts, the Lord Sabaoth, was going to protect him in that moment. So he simply says, Lord, open his eyes. And the servant opened his eyes. And he saw that the mountain was absolutely full of the armies and the chariots of God. Now, the third part of the climax is what the Syrians don't see. The servant saw an army. Elisha saw the Lord of hosts. The Syrians, well, they end up not seeing anything. There's a second prayer that is uttered now. And the second prayer that is uttered is simply this, verse 18. Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people with blindness, I pray. So he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. So immediately this great army, in the phraseology that's actually used here, is to dazzle their eyes. So whether they were totally blind or whether they just couldn't see straight, they were rendered absolutely impotent. And I love the scene here because now Elisha walks out of the city of Dothan, basically walks up to the commander. The Syrians are walking around trying to figure out where they're going. And Elisha simply reaches out to them and says, man, you guys seem lost. Can I help you find your way? Remember, I know who you're looking for. Follow me. And from Dothan to Samaria is a 12-mile walk. And so Elisha leads the army all the way into the city of Samaria. And when he gets to the city of Samaria, he opens their eyes at that point in time. And I love the irony of this. Now the resolution. Last part of the story, verses 20 through 23. Now Elisha prays a third time. We've even noted. O Lord, open the eyes of these men that now they can see. And the Lord opened their eyes and they saw. And behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. They're exposed. Now they see what Elisha wants them to see. And I love what the king of Israel does here. By the way, there's a great bit of humor here. The king of Israel simply cries out, can I kill them? Father, what am I supposed to do now? This is the king, by the way. All right, the king is supposed to be the competent one in the group. And he looks at him and he says, can I kill them? And Elisha says, no, you can't kill them. You don't kill prisoners of war. So get out some bread and some water and then let them go home. All right, so what does the king do? What's the text say? He doesn't bring out bread and water. He throws them a great feast. He says, oh, okay, if I'm supposed to feed them, well, let's feed them. Bring out the cattle. Let's have a feast. So they bring out the cattle. They have a great feast together. Then the Syrians go back home, and you have to imagine this. All of the army marches back into the king of Aram, and as they're coming back, the king of Aram would have looked at them and said, so where's Elisha? And I'm sure the captain of the guard, with some level of fear, probably walked up and said, well, we can't bring you Elisha, but here's a piece of cake. Got a doggy bag for you. That's all we can do at that point in time. The resolution of the story is simply this. And the Syrians didn't bother the Israelites anymore. God protected them. Okay, that's the story. Right, that's the totality of the story. You see the context with Elisha. You see the conflict. You see the climax. And the climax is built around this concept of seeing. It's also built around the concept of prayer. Three times, open their eyes, close their eyes. Three times, the prayer of Elisha goes forth. And then finally, you have a resolution to the story. All right, that's the story. Great story. Hilarious story, quite honestly. And the reason that it's included is, one, to teach us lessons. But not just to teach us lessons from an intellectual perspective, but to apply those lessons from the original reader's aspect within a life of exile, from our perspective within a life where the world is seemingly spinning out of control. What are the lessons? Five lessons for us this morning out of the story. Lesson number one is simply this. God will bring to shame those who oppose his people. Say it again. God will bring to shame those who oppose his people. When you look at this story, one of the things that should jump out to you is the simple reality that the Syrians, and really all of the kings in this particular story, are made to look like absolute fools. Individuals in positions of power, individuals with wealth and resources at their fingertips, individuals with armies that when they speak, they jump. And yet when God chooses to, in his time, he can make the mightiest individual look like an absolute fool. Should remind you of Psalm 2, where the psalmist simply says this, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves together and the rulers take counsel against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast away their cords from us." But listen to what the psalmist concludes. "He who sits in the heavens laughs, and the Lord holds them in derision." The people of God can have absolute confidence that scorners and mockers and those who press an anti-God agenda will ultimately be made low. The score at the end of the game is already given to us. Revelation chapter 19, 20, 21, 22. At the end of the game, the end of human history, God wins. Now, if you're in exile, like the children of Israel were, again, separated from your land, separated from your capital, separated from monarchy, seemingly separated from God, living underneath the control of the kings of Assyria and Babylon and the Medes and the Persians, you want to know that at the end of the day, God wins. And you want to know that at the end of the day, that those that scoff and mock at God will be made low. Can I just ask a simple question by way of application this morning? Is there any encouragement you find in that today? That those who seemingly speak with bold arrogance against our God, who clench their fist and hold it up and say, "I will be who I want to be, not who you make me to be. I will live the way that I want to live, and you cannot control me. I will absolutely make sure that you have no place, no voice, God, in the marketplace at all. We are in control." That at the end of the day, God wins. When you read this story, that's one of the principles. It's one of the lessons. It's one of the truths that should absolutely encourage your heart. Second truth is simply this. God's defense of his people is not dependent upon wise or godly leadership. It is one thing to communicate that the king of Syria or the king of Aram looks like a fool. But in this particular story, and again, throughout the history of the kings of the north, they all acted like fools. They all acted like rebels toward God. The king of Israel is portrayed as impotent as the king of Syria. He's completely dependent upon Elisha for everything. His safety earlier in the story was dependent upon Elisha. His proper understanding of what to do in warfare was dependent upon Elisha. And even then, he goes overboard as it relates to the prophet's instructions. Just communicate this.
God has no foes that can stand against him, and he can use any fool to accomplish his will. That's an encouragement to the children of Israel. That's an encouragement while they're in exile and they're looking for some godly leadership to rise, and there's seemingly very little. Again, just personal question here. I'll let you ruminate on this within the context of your own heart. Are there times that you look, even within the context of our country, and you say, where is the wise and godly leadership? And at times our hearts can get discouraged and we simply say, Lord, we're seemingly surrounded by foes and fools. Can I simply say this? God's hand is not short that he cannot save. The story of the Old Testament is filled with God using people just like that. One of the things that Dwayne mentioned is that I teach homiletics, or I've taught in Christian colleges. And one of the most encouraging stories in the Old Testament for those of us that are preachers or those of us that aspire to be preachers or pastors at some point is when you get into the Old Testament, it's a wonderful story about Balaam. And Balaam is a prophet who has no desire really to follow God, and yet God uses him anyway. But it's not just that God uses Balaam, but what's most encouraging is that God actually uses Balaam's donkey. You remember the story? Balaam is trying to get to a particular location, and the donkey stands up and says, don't go there. Don't you see? Again, theme of sight here. Don't you see the angel right there with the sword in his hand? I simply communicate to young guys that are preachers. I say, listen, if God can use Balaam's ass, he can use you. Now, that doesn't mean that we should aspire toward that. But the reality is that's an encouragement to me. God can use foes, God can use fools to protect his people and to accomplish his will. And that's exactly what we see within the story. Now, those two principles, as I mentioned earlier, are principles that address primarily individuals outside of the people of God. The king of Israel was not an individual that was a godly individual, and certainly not the king of Aram. But what are the lessons that we can learn for those that desire to be the servants of God? I think these lessons are bound within the actions of both the servant and the actions of Elisha. Three principles that come a little bit closer to our heart and to our home. Principle number one in these, or principle number three in totality, is simply this. God uses servants who see clearly. Simple truth. God uses servants who see clearly. I want you to evaluate the servant's response and ask yourself the question, how do I know if I am seeing the invisible hand of God? How do I know if I am responding like the servant or like the seer? I think if you look within the context, what the servant's thought processes revolve around are three realities. Number one is he forgot the past. The servant wakes up in the morning and he looks out and he says, alas, what are we to do? Was he not aware of what even the unsaved individuals in Aram were aware of? And that was that Elisha could hear the words of the king even in his bedroom. Even an unbeliever recognized that. And yet in the moment of trial, in the moment of pressure, this servant suddenly forgot the past. Forgot that Elisha had saved the king's life multiple times over. Not only did he forget the past, but he fixated on the present. He woke up, he looked out, he saw the enemy, and that was all that filled his mind. He was intimidated, he was outnumbered, and as far as he was concerned, he could not see beyond that which he could touch. That which was within arm's length. That which was present. Not only that, he also feared the future. He simply said, what are we supposed to do? What are we going to do? Panic fills the soul. Lord, everything's out of control now. Again, let me just ask the simple question. I know I've been here. Have you ever been in a position where life suddenly has unexpected, undesired circumstances, and there's a sense of panic that absolutely grips your heart, and you cry out to God, alas, what am I to do? Can I simply ask, where does your heart go when those moments come? Duane had mentioned travel. I mentioned earlier going to China. This took place around, it was almost 12 years ago now. There is a particular airport in southern China outside the city of Kunming. And the airport actually no longer exists simply because it was rated one of the most 5 difficult airports to fly into. And it was an airport that I flew into on a regular basis. And I'll simply say, it was absolutely thrilling. It was like riding a roller coaster. You came in over the mountains, the plane would drop straight down, and then you would land, and you had sheer winds going left and right, and you never knew if you actually were going to touch the ground or not. One particular afternoon when I was flying into Kunming, the winds were horrific, the rain was coming, and the pilot would just continue to move from Chengdu down into Kunming. I knew where we were. I knew we were about ready to go over the mountains, and as we went over the mountains, all of a sudden, he started dropping that plane, and everyone could feel that plane dropping, and as that plane was dropping, winds were coming from the north to the south in that particular situation, and the plane felt like a tin can in the middle of a rainstorm, just getting pushed back and forth. And what I loved, that I was actually the only American on the plane. And from a Chinese perspective, all the Chinese on the plane, they were very vocal. So every single time that plane moved, everyone would go, oh, 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 wah. And the entire plane was just verbalizing this roller coaster of a ride. And as we were pressing down to the ground, I thought, he's certainly not going to bring this in. We got right down to where the runway was. I could look out my window and I could see the runway. And then all of a sudden, a sheer wind came. And that plane felt like it was just picked up and moved about 30 feet. The runway was below us. And all of a sudden, the runway was somewhere else. And at that point in time, that pilot absolutely hit the throttle. And that plane started taking back off. And then you had to get back over the mountains, which was a thrill ride in itself. All right, as this was taking place, everyone was communicating verbally their emotions except one person. I was sitting in a window seat. There was a man beside me, and there was a man on the aisle. And the man on the aisle, from the moment we got on that plane, had started drinking. He was already at least on his 3rd, if not 4th beer at that point in time. And as we were riding that roller coaster up and down, he just had a big smile on his face the entire time. He was just sitting there, back going, And I thought to myself for a moment, this man has more confidence in 3 beers than I have in all the promises of God. I was fearing for what was next. He had no fear whatsoever. Elisha's servant wakes up in the morning, goes out. He sees the army, and his heart is absolutely filled with fear. He forgets the past. He's fixated on the present, and he has absolutely no thought regarding the future of any of the promises of God. God uses individuals who see clearly. How does God address the shortcomings of this servant? And I love the way that Elisha deals with him. We've already noted it as far as the text. The Lord doesn't just rebuke him. The Lord offers words of personal encouragement through the mouth of the prophet Elisha. Do not fear. Be encouraged. Why? Because biblical truth is foundational within our lives. And the biblical truth is simply this, is there are more on our side than on their side. You don't need to cry out, alas. God is for us, and greater is he that is within us than he that is within the world, to use the words of John. Don't fear. See clearly. And then finally, the prophet simply said, open your eyes. Open your eyes and recognize the very thing that Paul communicated in 2 Corinthians. For we look not to things which are seen, but to things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are transient, but the things which are unseen are eternal. Each morning, you and I get out of bed and we make a decision. And we make a decision whether we're going to open our eyes and we're going to walk by faith. Please note the words there. Sometimes we say we're not going to walk by sight, but by faith. And I'll simply say that walking by faith is walking by sight when we have our eyes fixated on the promises of God. We might not see everything that's around us, but when we're looking vertically, then we see God as he is, who he is. And what that allows us to do is that allows us to move forward without fear. We see clearly. Paul continues actually in the book of Ephesians when the end of his prayer, it's a powerful prayer, he simply says this, picking it up in verse 18 of Ephesians chapter 1, I do not cease to give thanks for you, remembering you in my prayers that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give you the spirit of wisdom and of revelation in the knowledge of him. Now catch what he says here by way of request. Having the eyes of your heart enlightened, that you may know. In other words, what Paul is saying is this, those in the church of Ephesus, may God open the eyes of your inner man, of your heart, that you may know, that you may have confidence in. And then he states three things that he wants them to have confidence in. What is, number one, the hope to which he has called you? Number two, what are the riches of the glorious inheritance in the saints? And number three, what is the immeasurable greatness of his power toward us who believe according to the working of his great might? When God opens the eyes of our hearts, then we can see him as he is. And when we see him as he is, our eyes are fixated on the eternal riches of our glorious inheritance in heaven. And when our eyes are focused on that, the wealth of this world is transient. We recognize that immediately because our eyes have been opened at that point in time. We know the immeasurable greatness of God's power. And when we know that, the limited power of this world and of those who suggest that they have power is seen as what it is, the work of an ant against their creator. And we can trust in the incredible providence and sovereignty of God who controls all things. I think one lesson that we can learn from this particular story is simply this, is that God uses individuals, God uses servants who see clearly. Oh, that we might be like Elisha with open eyes, and that our prayer would be like Paul, Lord, open the eyes of our hearts. I think that's a first practical lesson for us. Second practical lesson for us out of this story is simply this. God uses servants who pray powerfully. Everything in this story is actually framed around verses 17, 18, and 20. Just cast your eyes back on the text. When you look at the text, 17, 18, and 20, note the three prayers of Elisha. Oh Lord, I pray, open his eyes. Verse 18, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people. And then again, verse 20, O Lord, open the eyes of these men. Now, I want you to capture this. What is significant about these prayers in the midst of the battle? I think what it communicates is simply this, is that prayer evidences that God does not use ordinary or expected artillery to win the battles to protect his people. Really, when you trace the work of God throughout history, both biblical history and even church history, what you see is that God, by and large, dismisses ordinary means of accomplishing warfare. Think for a moment. Judges chapter 6, he defeats the Midianites with a simple shout from Gideon. 1 Samuel chapter 12, he defeats Goliath with a small stone launched by a shepherd boy. 2 Kings 18, he defeats the Ethiopians by a song that's emanating from the camp. God loves to accomplish his warfare by spiritual means, not by natural means. And those spiritual means include the power of prayer. Again, Paul knows this as far as the Old Testament is concerned. For though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. Why? For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have the divine power to destroy strongholds. God's weapons are not physical weapons. God uses spiritual tools to accomplish spiritual victories. So, when we see the world that is seemingly spinning out of control, When we take all of our energies, all of our anxieties, and we insert them into the warfare in the exact same way that the world is fighting, may I simply suggest that we will not win that battle. You will not win the battle on social media. You will not win the battle on blogs. You will not win the battle. And I do believe that we should not be passive. We should be active citizens within our country. Vocal. No problems with that whatsoever. But we will not win the battle through the ballot box. Because the battle is greater than that. And the way that God wins battles is not through hands, but through prayer. Through knees. It's his rules of engagement. In what world does paper actually beat rock? If I were to say go to war and you have a choice between rock and paper, okay, I think every single one of us would say, give me the rock, unless you're playing rock, paper, scissors. And in rock, paper, scissors, who wins, paper or rock? Rock, paper covers rock. Paper wins. Why? Because the rules of engagement in that particular task, in that particular game, is that paper is superior to rock. Can I simply say that God's rules of engagement as it relates to spiritual warfare is that prayer is superior to everything? You note this all throughout the text. You note this all throughout history. What does God do when people pray? Let me go all the way back to 1857. 1857, there was a revival here in the United States that was defined as the prayer meeting revival. Started with a New York businessman by the name of Jeremiah Lamphere. He was not a preacher. He was simply a lay leader within the Old Dutch Reformed Church on Fulton Street, down in the Wall Street section of New York City. The church itself had pretty much collapsed and had folded. He was given the responsibility of bringing in some level of revitalization. He was not a preacher. He was not a scholar. So what he decided to do was to have noonday prayer meetings. He made a little sign. He put it outside the church. He carried it around through the marketplace. He affixed a particular date on it and said, if you would like to pray for our country, the doors will be open at noon, and you can come for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or 15 minutes. The very first date was September 23rd, 1857. Noon struck, no one was there. 15 minutes later, six individuals walked up the steps. And those six individuals met on the main floor of that church. They prayed for around 15 minutes, and they decided to do it 1 week later. On October 30th, 20 individuals met for prayer. The following week, 40 individuals came, October 7th. At that point in time, they determined to have the meetings on a daily basis. By mid-January, the totality of that church, first floor, second floor, and third floor, were all filled with over 3,000 people. They were turning people away. Other churches started opening their doors. Then theaters started opening their doors. Then it went from New York City to Philadelphia, and from Philadelphia up to Boston, and then over to Baltimore, and then Washington, D.C., and then it made its way down the eastern seaboard. It lasted for 18 months. Noonday prayer meetings. No one preacher, just simply men and women gathering together for prayer. Let me read for you the New York Times response to this. The article simply says this: the great wave of religious excitement which is now sweeping over the nation is one of the most remarkable movements since the Reformation. In this city, we have beheld a sight which not the most enthusiastic fanatics of church observance could ever have hoped to look upon. We have seen in a business quarter of the city, in the busiest hours, assemblies of merchants, clerks, and working men to the number of some 5,000 gathered day after day in each location for solemn prayer and worship. Similar assemblies we find in other portions of the city, a theater turned into a chapel. Churches of all sects are open and crowded day and night. The most conservative of church historians suggests that somewhere between 300,000 to 1 million actually accepted Christ during those 18 months. All in preparation, based upon God's providence, for the coming event, which we define as the Civil War. Individuals that were preparing eternally for what physically was going to come upon them. Why did the noonday prayer meeting happen? Because one man did all that he knew, all that he could do, and that was he simply prayed. He simply prayed. What do we learn from this story? We learn that God uses servants who pray powerfully. Elisha prayed, and eyes were opened. Elisha prayed, and eyes were closed. Elisha prayed, and eyes were reopened. God still answers prayer. It's the third lesson that's to be learned, and just briefly, God uses servants who respond graciously. I love the end of the story. Elisha, at times, certainly when you read his story, rendered judgments that were direct and at times bloody. But in this particular instance, Elisha's response to his enemy was a response of absolute grace. These were the very armies that were seeking his death and the death of the king. And when he had them in his hand, he simply said, feed them. Just feed them. Feed them and send them home. Let's exercise grace in this moment. What gave Elisha the capacity to do that? I will simply suggest that when you don't fear the future because you see God, then you can treat your enemies with love and respect because you know the end game. You don't have to be the end all in their life. You can entrust them to God because you have entrusted yourself to God. This is a great story. This is a story where faith is the absolute central message. Faith in a God who sees, faith in a God who protects, faith in a God who's in total control. Faith that allows one to pray in absolute trust and to dwell peacefully among the enemy and to sleep restfully even while the enemy is around you. What are our takeaways from this story? I simply suggest, oh, that we would see the invisible. No panic, no doubt, no concern. But we would approach life with the poise and the confidence of Elisha. Oh, that we would learn to pray. And trust that God can work on our behalf far greater than we ever could. And oh, that we would learn to extend grace to those who stand against us. I think our prayer should simply be, Lord, open our eyes that we may see. Open our mouths that we could pray. And open our hearts that we can extend graciousness. Because we have a God who protects and provides. And who opens our eyes. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your goodness. Thank you for this little story. And I recognize that the story itself was written to be an encouragement to the original readers, but what an encouragement it is to us. Their world was spinning out of control, and yet at times our world spins out of control. Personally, nationally, and even internationally, things that are beyond our ability to understand. And yet nothing is beyond your ability. Father, open our eyes that we would see what you are doing, our mouths that we would pray, and that we'd understand that there is power and that that's the way that you win spiritual victory so that you could be glorified. And then, Lord, open our hearts that we might be gracious in the midst of warfare so that individuals would understand that we are owned by you and not motivated by any other agenda in this world. Lord, as you would accomplish this, we'll give you thanks in your name. Amen.